Welcome to IFA Talk, IFA Magazine's weekly podcast. IFA Talk is for professional investors only. Thank you.
Thanks very much for joining us for the latest episode of IFA Talk, IFA Magazine's weekly podcast, where we talk to people who matter about the things that matter in the world of financial services. I'm Brandon Russell, online writer here at IFA Magazine, and joining me on the podcast this week is our editor, Sue Whitbread.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the podcast, and we're talking investment this week. But we're all used to working with uncertainty, aren't we? When it comes to investment strategy and asset allocation, it's just always there. But let's face it, there's just a little bit more of it than usual. Swashing around in 2024, whether it's elections, inflation, recessions, interest rates, geopolitical stuff, climate change, I could go on. Anyway, we thought it'd be a really good time to talk about more defensive assets in today's podcast and find out where there may be some decent opportunities, where the risks may be, and so on. So today's guest is a friend of the podcast because it's his third time on IFA Talk. Can't quite believe that. But it's Jason Barbara-Sheen, a diversified income fund portfolio manager at 91. Jason, welcome back. Good to see you again. Can I ask you to start us off a bit briefly? Tell us a bit about you and your role at 91 for those who may not know.
Yes, of course. So I have been at 91 for coming up to 10 years now. We run, and that's when I say we, John Stopford and I are the two portfolio managers on the Diversified Income Fund. And it's essentially a defensive alternative, defensive in that it's seeking to navigate upside and downside better than traditional assets. An alternative because it's using, yes, sort of straightforward assets, typically just bonds or some bonds and bond-like instruments, and combining that with derivatives mostly to manage downside risks in the fund.
Thanks for coming back on to talk to us again, Jason. A combination of higher rates compared to the last 10 years and tax efficiency have made short-term maturity gilt really popular with investors. What's your view on the market at the moment?
So I think that move by investors has been very sensible. Ultimately, you're getting rewarded with a much higher rate of interest on those bonds and a very tax efficient treatment of them, where that matters in portfolios, than you have done for a long time. And as such, we've seen an enormous amount of money move into that area of the market. We can look across different measures of that, but it's probably close to all-time highs across most geographies. People are making that change towards those short duration maturity, short maturity bonds. I think ultimately that is starting to wane in its sensible, the nature of how sensible that is. And there are a number of reasons behind that, which we can explore shortly perhaps. But ultimately, I think that there are opportunities that are being left on the table through simply allocating to those very, yes, risk-free assets, but ultimately ones which are unable to participate in upside. And so we think that investors now need to be a bit more inventive with what they're doing. And ultimately, you don't typically get rewarded for just putting all your eggs in one basket and entirely following what others are doing. You typically get rewarded for some diversification.
Yeah, you just mentioned that. And bond rates have come down, haven't they, compared to even where they were this time last year, Jason. And as you just alluded to there are many good reasons for that. But I wonder, where are you seeing the state of play just now? I'm guessing, as you just mentioned, about eggs in baskets, and you know, we are around Easter time. You won't really want to have all your eggs in one basket, would you?
Absolutely. So when we look at bond rates, they are anticipating a decline in cash rates. So the cash rate in the UK is still at around 5.25%, and that's not moved. And you can probably get in many cash accounts a little bit more than that, depending on how you lock your money up for. But ultimately, I think there are four decent reasons for not just putting all of your eggs into one basket. And this is sort of true irrespective of the time of year, but ultimately the first is that opportunity cost point. So it can seem quite compelling upfront to be paid. Now you're getting sort of 4%, but a year ago you're getting 5%. But it can seem quite compelling to get that sort of guaranteed level of rate on a short maturity bond, and you get that tax efficient treatment of it. But ultimately then, if other things perform much better than that, you're left constantly trying to run to catch up with those assets. And through time, as most people are aware, it's that sort of time in the market, it's not time in the market, it's dynamic that you end up being exposed to in those assets. So yes, they're compelling, but there's an opportunity cost involved. The second, I think, concern, and it's somewhat related, is they have so little flexibility in them. So cash is king when it's held in a sort of liquid format. But when you tie it up for a year or two, you're unable to take advantage of any sudden shifts in the market. And as you suggested, we've had numerous examples of that just over the last 5 years, where you've had multiple 20 to 40% drawdowns in various assets that you really do need to be able to take advantage of and actually use any dry powder you have. And I think one interesting element of derivatives is that you can do that, because ultimately the way that we run our strategy is to have essentially a bond portfolio from a cash perspective. So it's primarily bonds that we're holding, pretty straightforward sovereign bonds. But then we use derivatives around that to alter our exposure. And that means we can take advantage of opportunities when they present themselves. And that, I think, is going to be quite important in the current climate, because if our view on rates, which is that ultimately they are going to come down, they may not come down to the level that they were at before COVID, but they are going to come down, then your reinvestment risk is quite significant. Ultimately, if you hold your cash balance for a year or so, and then rates are at 3% when you had initially invested at between 4 and 5, you're unable to attain those same levels of return. Other assets may have done much better and revalued in that context. And that takes me to the final point. There's an inefficiency, I think, of when cash rates are high in just putting everything that you've got into it. And that's because you fail to take advantage of the cushioning or building block effect that high cash rates or high risk-free rates can have. So let's say you've got a high interest rate, 5%. On your cash assets, if you put some of your future or new money into riskier assets, those cash that you hold, those cash assets that you own, can offset any potential losses in those. So if we take our fund as an example, say you had put 60% of your cash into the risk-free rate at 5%. So you were earning that 5% every 12 months. You'd then put 40% of your assets into our strategy. That combined holding would never have lost money over any 12-month period. So that's looking at every single rolling 12-month timeframe, including during COVID, when you had enormous risk-off effects. So if I think you use cash as a building block and not as the only thing you run to and hide it, then ultimately it can bolster returns in good environments, because that combination of 60-40's best 12 months would have been over 10% return, but then defend you in those worse environments. And it's all about selecting what you step away from cash into. If you did the same with equity, you'd have a big drawdown still, because equities have got a significant left tail, as they say. It means that you have big drawdowns in risk-off environments. But if you're owning things that have got good risk-reward, decent upside participation versus downside, you can actually make use of the rates available to you. So that's why I think you don't just put everything in one basket. And I think, unfortunately, some have done that, and there has been some good returns over the last 12 months. But I don't think that we are in a place to say that there aren't good returns elsewhere. We're still seeing, for example, New Zealand, Australian government bonds offer very attractive potential returns from here on.
You are listening to IFA Talk, IFA Magazine's weekly podcast. Subscribe to us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts to be notified as soon as a new episode becomes available. And follow us on LinkedIn, Twitter and Instagram at IFA Magazine.
So Jason, interesting where you were just talking there about your approach and those four reasons. I wonder then what you think advisors should really be thinking about when selecting portfolio managers for that more defensive positioning in their clients' portfolios.
So I think when you're talking about defense, normally you're really thinking about alternatives. And in that space, I think there are three questions you should probably ask yourself. So the first is quite straightforward. An alternative should be diversifying. It should be able to provide you with less volatility than a traditional asset, either by tweaking the outcomes, so it's upside versus downside is better, or by doing something entirely unrelated to traditional assets. So when markets go down, it's going up. The second thing I think you should be doing is dependable. It should be something that you can rely on, and it doesn't suddenly surprise to the downside when it goes wrong. And all strategies at some point will be tested and found wanting, but it's the magnitude of that disappointment which is important. And if you can understand when it's going to go wrong and why, then ultimately you are, I think, able to tolerate that when it happens. And at some point, every strategy will go through that. The final thing it should be doing is offering something which is ultimately different to the things that an investor themselves can do. So whether that is using securities which they don't normally buy, you know, we talked about New Zealand government bonds there, they're 20 basis points of a traditional bond index, but at points in time they've been 10-15% of our strategy. So it's different from that perspective, or it's different because you're using instruments or able to use instruments that your investors don't or can't. So for example, derivatives like options or swaps to manage risks in the fund. And I think when combined, that those attributes of being diversifying, of being dependable, being different are key to offering a defensive alternative return profile.
So Jason, as we come towards the end of today's episode then, investors have tended to focus less on alternatives as cash rates have increased. However, do you think that the uncertainty of future outcomes demands a reappraisal of non-traditional assets? And where are you seeing the main upside and downside risks in the bond market?
That's a good question, I think, ultimately, given what I said just then. I think alternatives have become less appealing as cash rates have gone up simply because they've been able to get those defensive, dependable characteristics from gilts or from short maturity bonds elsewhere. I think, firstly, there's those four points I made around opportunity cost, reinvestment risk, flexibility, and cushioning to think more broadly around alternatives. I think, secondly, rates have actually come down a bit, and so the relative attractive characteristics of other alternatives have gone up. But I think, thirdly, it's about those alternatives being able to demonstrate that they can fulfill that role in portfolios. So we see ourselves as a step away from cash or from gilts and into more risky markets, but we don't see ourselves as sort of equity like or even gilt like. We're much less, I think, exposed to downside than either of those two blunt asset classes. And so I think when it comes to reappraising non-traditional assets, it is about understanding ultimately how dependable are these things. Many investors have allocated to, and the sort of road is littered with, very risky, quite sort of obscure strategies to navigate an alternatives landscape. I think those days are probably largely behind us simply because investors want to understand what it is they're exposed to. I think other investors have tended to buy assets like infrastructure funds where they've been really hard hit during the last couple of years. And actually they look more compelling now than they have done for a while. So I think the alternatives landscape, whether that is from a strategy perspective like our own, or it's from an actual asset perspective like infrastructure, they all look more compelling than they have done in a while. And those that have been able to show their ability to diversify, to be dependable, and ultimately to be different, I think there's a place in the portfolio for them. And as cash rates change from here, I think that place grows.
So Jason, where are you seeing the main upside and downside risks then in the bond market?
So for us, I think the sovereign area presents the greatest potential upside, and that's because you're getting a decent income stream. You're getting on top of that the potential for capital gains if rate cuts come through. I think rate cuts have seen enormous volatility in terms of the range of expectations just over the last few months without any significant central bank action. So that's not to say that these assets aren't going to be volatile, but ultimately, I think from here, given what's priced in currently, any downside surprise to growth or inflation data could reignite quite a significant capital gains rally. The area that's probably the least compelling is corporate bonds. And here we see essentially a coin toss between whether you make or lose money relative to governments, given where spreads are. So our view on corporate bonds is through a spreads lens. What do you get on a corporate bond versus a government? And that is now very tight. That differential is very low. And if you look historically from here on in, it tends to be an environment where you don't make significant gains relative to government. So in a good scenario, you probably earn the additional yield. In a bad scenario, which we've seen during recessionary environments, that's not to say a recession is our base case, but we have to look at all potential cases, you could lose significantly more in absolute terms and certainly relative than a government bond.
Interesting. Thank you, Jay. And interesting times to be in bonds and in your area of the market, the more defensive side of things.
Yes, absolutely. I think we've had much more engagement than we have for the past few years, given just where yields are.
Indeed. It'll be interesting to see where things go now for the rest of the year. So thank you. That conversation has run by far too quickly. So we shall have to draw a conclusion to it for today. So it remains for us to thank you again for coming and sharing your time with us and your thoughts. We really do appreciate that. And also thank you to our listeners for tuning in again. We hope you found that of interest. And do tune again into IFA Talk again next week. Thank you very much.
Perfect. Thanks, everybody.
IFA Talk is for investment professionals only. All material has been carefully checked for accuracy, but no responsibility can be accepted for inaccuracies. Wherever appropriate, independent research and whatever necessary legal advice should be sought before acting on any information contained in this podcast. And value of investments and income from them can go down as well as up. You may not get back the amount you originally invested.